In this room, we're in Ecclesiastes chapter 9 and verse 10 is where we'll start, and we'll go all the way through chapter 10. Ecclesiastes 9, 10. Now, I have enough people here that are visiting today that I want to go through some of the foundation that we have built on wisdom. If you were to approach wisdom literature in the Bible, you're talking about some books of the Bible that are classified as wisdom literature: Job, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. And as we approach wisdom literature, we want to think about how to look at these books. How do we approach them individually? If you were to look at the first nine chapters of the book of Proverbs, that would be an introduction to wisdom. My son, the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord, and just simple instruction. But then you get to the second half of, or second part of Proverbs, chapters 10 through 31. And he takes a step back, and it's kind of like if you're a freshman in college, you're taking English 101. Well, the second part of the book of Proverbs is the 202 class. And you'll see Proverbs in the second half that conflict one another. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest he turn and rend you. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. Those Proverbs are right next to each other, and they conflict each other, and they tell you, living by wisdom takes some thought, and it's not this pat answer that's always the same in every single case. Wisdom with literature requires that we sometimes shut the mouth, take it in, live with some questions, and perhaps have an answer. But if you're going to be living with the wisdom of God, it's going to be a difficult thing. It's going to be a little more complicated in that second half of Proverbs. In the first half of the book of Job, we have our junior level class in wisdom, because Job's friends come together and they've got wisdom figured out. They know wisdom. No, they don't. They think that because Job is suffering and God blesses the righteous and God only punishes the wicked, that Job must have done something wicked. And so you have these three men giving their monologues. And at first they're really long monologues, and then they get shorter and shorter. And then at the end they kind of fizzle out and go away in chapter 31, by chapter 31. So we have this deconstruction of wisdom in Job 1 through 31, where we realize we don't know wisdom. It's not as simple as we think it is. In the last part of the book of Job, chapters 32 through 42, we get answers. We get answers from God, but they're not the kind of answers we want. They're answers like, where were you when I formed the world? Who are you to judge me and to judge what I am doing in my world? Answer me like a man. Can you stand up to God? And it's just not the kind of answers we want. And we start to realize at that point that wisdom is very high. And I like to point to this peak in the roof. If we could use this as an illustration, God's wisdom is way up there. It is high. It is above us. And we are ants on the ground, and we have his word. It's not an exhaustive treatment on God's wisdom. His wisdom's infinite. But it's sufficient. It's entirely sufficient for what we need in this lifetime. And as we begin to grow in God's wisdom, we remove ourselves from the floor of humanity and we start to work our way toward God. Yet this will always be like a foreign culture. If you visit a foreign country and you understand how they use bride price in their marriage arrangements, you understand how they arrange their marriages or do things that are different, you might understand, but you will never fully understand, will you? I mean, sometimes you'll make too much of little things and too little of big things, and you will never be at home in this foreign culture. Similarly, when mankind lives in the wisdom of God, we're never fully at home. We never fully have it figured out from beginning to the end. And so here we are in the book of Ecclesiastes, a book which is almost deconstructive throughout of human wisdom. It seems to take away a lot of the things that we assume. And we open with this book of Ecclesiastes, and it really, to me, was so dark, I didn't want to study it. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity, says the preacher. Ew. It's just not a real attractive opening there in verse 2. And so I've kind of shunned away from it, and yet there was something that kept ringing in my ear about the book of Ecclesiastes that drew me toward it. There's nothing better than for man to rejoice and enjoy the fruit of his labors, for this is God's gift to man. This invitation to rejoice in what God has given you in this lifetime. And I'm like, oh, that sounds so winsome. What is the key to understanding this book? Or what is, you know, help me out here. And what I found was, as you read those first two chapters of the book of Ecclesiastes, it's just depressing. You know, you're going to live, you're going to die, and you're going to be forgotten. You're never going to make any difference. Any money you get, any material stuff you get, it's all vanity, it's all empty, it's all fleeting. And if you do amass a great deal of wealth, you're going to die and leave it to someone, and who knows what that guy's going to do with it. Okay, and so, you know, I'm like, it's really dark for those two chapters until you get to chapter 2, verse 24. And in chapter 2, verse 24, even after Solomon in 118 had said, wisdom and knowledge are vexation and sorrow, we get to chapter 2, verse 24, and something changes because God enters the picture. In 2:24, he says, there is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? Rhetorical question. The answer is no one. For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. Wisdom and knowledge were vexation and sorrow back in 118. But when God enters the picture, wisdom and knowledge can be acquired with joy. And so all of a sudden now I really love the book of Ecclesiastes because I'm seeing that God is the one who makes the difference. And yes, it's going to be a book that's going to challenge us throughout. It's going to make us say, well, I really don't know the ways of God. I really do have to live with a lot of questions in life. A lot of things that I don't know, things that are going on in your life and my life where I can't explain them from beginning to end and how God is going to turn anything in this life into something good eternally. But nonetheless, I am confident in this. There is a God, and he judges. He judges good works and evil works, and he sets everything right in the end. And that is the message that I am seeing in the book of Ecclesiastes. So as we look at this wisdom that's been placed on a fairly high shelf, okay, it's like we're little kids trying to jump up and reach at it, and we can't. But it is profitable. It is good. And Solomon even described to us life that happens somewhat randomly in terms of how we experience it. And yet, in chapter 3, he said God has ordained a time for every activity of man, every event of man. If there's all of this seeming randomness, and if wisdom is so high, why even try? Why pursue it? Solomon is going to answer that why you should pursue it today, and he's going to answer that you should pursue it with boldness, that you should aggressively, with all your might, pursue wisdom for this life, even if it's high. Even if you're never going to fully acquire it, pursue it. It's good for you. Let's read in chapter 10, verse 20. I'm sorry, chapter 9 and verse 10 is where I'm picking up today. Chapter 9 and verse 10. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in the grave to which you are going. Again, I saw that under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge. But time and chance happen to them all. For man does not know his time, like fish that are taken in an evil net, and like birds that are caught in a snare, so the children of man are snared at an evil time, when it suddenly falls upon them. Also, I have seen this example of wisdom under the sun, and it seemed great to me. There was a little city with few men in it, and a great king came against it and besieged it, building great siege works against it. But there was found in it a poor, wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city. Yet no one remembered that poor man. But I say that wisdom is better than might. Though the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. The words of the wise heard in quiet are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war. But one sinner destroys much good. Dead flies make the perfumer's ointment give off a stench. So a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor. A wise man's heart inclines him to the right, but a fool's heart to the left. Even when a fool walks on the road, he lacks sense, and he says to everyone that he is a fool.
If the anger of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your place, for calmness will lay great offenses to rest. There is an evil that I have seen under the sun, as it were an error proceeding from the ruler. Folly is set in many high places, and the rich, or nobility, sit in a low place. I have seen slaves on horses and princes walking on the ground like slaves. He who digs a pit will fall into it. A serpent will bite him who breaks through a wall. He who quarries stone is hurt by them, and he who splits logs is endangered by them. If the iron is blunt and one does not sharpen the edge, he must use more strength. But wisdom helps one to succeed. If the serpent bites before it is charmed, there is no advantage to the charmer. The words of a wise man's mouth win him favor, but the lips of a fool consume him. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is evil madness. A fool multiplies words, though no man knows what is to be, and who can tell him what will be after him. The toil of a fool wearies him, for he does not know the way to the city. Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child, and your princes feast in the morning. Happy are you, O land, when your king is the son of the nobility, and your princes feast at the proper time, for strength and not for drunkenness. Through sloth the roof sinks in, and through indolence or idleness the house leaks. Bread is made for laughter, and wine gladdens life, and money answers everything. Even in your thoughts, do not curse the king, nor in your bedroom curse the rich, for a bird of the air will carry your voice, or some winged creature tell the matter. Let's pray. Father, as we look at this wisdom literature today, I pray that you'd give us clarity in understanding the structure and the different venues that Solomon is presenting to us. And I pray, God, that we would understand your word and understand how to behave as we walk your earth as your children. Bless us, God. In Jesus' name we ask, amen. So as we look down our outlines here, as we look at point number one this morning, what I think I see in verse 10 is this: do not allow the mysteries of life to diminish your diligence in labor, or in this passage, your diligence in pursuing wisdom. Verse 10, I said last week, I didn't know if it went with the previous section or the next, but if we take it with this section, it says here, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might, for there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in the grave to which you are going. If you look in verse 5 a little bit earlier, it addressed this concept of work now while you're alive. And of course, you remember I brought the rope in from outside, the rope that goes to every point in the universe, which there are infinite number of points, okay? And your life is that little piece of duct tape at the end of the rope, and this life affects everything, okay? And so as we look at this life, it's the one opportunity we have to affect eternity. Okay, and so if we look at verse 5, for the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing, and they have no more reward, for their memory of them is forgotten. Their love and their hate and their envy have already perished, and forever they have no more share in all that is done under the sun. And so we looked at that phrase, and we had three different interpretations we considered last week. We talked about it in the evening. And what we are seeing here, if we understand this right, is what he is saying when he says there's no work or thought or knowledge in the grave to which you are going, is that this is the one opportunity you have for all of eternity to impact eternity, to impact eternal reward. Have you trusted Jesus Christ as your Savior in this lifetime? Because that affects everything out there forever. This is your one opportunity. Now, some people will look at this and scholars will say, oh, see, Koheleth, the author, Solomon, if you will, he had no idea about the resurrection. He had no idea about an eternal state of man. To him, man lived, man died, and man ceased to exist. That's really not fair. To say that was Solomon's belief ignores chapter 12, verse 7, when he talks about the spirit of man returning to the Lord who gave it, and chapter 12, verse 14, when he says, God will judge every deed of man and every secret thing, whether good or evil. So, you know, we would no more do this to Solomon than we would do with Jesus. Jesus said, I think it's John 9:4, work, for the night is coming when no man can work. we would not say of Jesus, oh, he had no concept of the eternal state. And so I would not say it of Solomon either. So as he talks about working now, he's talking about this is your opportunity now to impact eternity. Also, he may be diminishing, we discussed this last week, he may be diminishing the role of ancestors in our lives. Because in much of the world, people worship their ancestors. They pray to their ancestors. That we like to think of our dead loved ones looking down upon us, and maybe we could even speak to them. And maybe we could speak to them and they could speak to God. And Solomon here is saying, none of that. None of that. The dead do not apply to this realm. You apply to this realm while you are living. Make the most of it. Pursue wisdom. Letter A here. You cannot always predict individual success in this realm, even based on performance. Life involves the appearance of chance. I used the titles probabilities and statistics last week, that it's really a valid way to look at life as a distribution of activities. Look at verses 11 and 12. Again, I saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise. You would think the wise would have bread on their table, but he says, not always. Nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge. But time and chance happen to them all. That word chance could also be translated occurrence. Time and occurrence happen to them all. For man does not know his time. Like fish that are taken in an evil net, and like birds that are caught in a snare, so the children of man are snared at an evil time when it suddenly falls upon them. Life doesn't always yield the results you would expect. And as you experience life, time and chance are good adjectives to describe how it's going to feel. Look at chapter 9, verse 1. It talks about there, we're in the hands of God. It says, I laid all this to heart, examining it all. The righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hand of God. Whether it is love or hate, man does not know. I take from that verse and from others in this book that you cannot look at your wallet and count the money and say, God loves me. You cannot look at your wallet and see the lack of money and say, God hates me. That you cannot look at whatever diagnosis you got at your last physical and say, God loves me or God hates me. And that, you know, as you look at the probability that you might get in an accident on the way home today, that statistically speaking, it's somewhat equal to the unsaved world. Oh, there might be some factors such as alcohol consumption that might increase risks for them, or texting that might increase risks for you. But overall, there's some statistical distribution of the activities of life, and God has designed it that way so that we would experience life that way. So the wisdom of God is not something where I can walk up to somebody and say, because you've lived your life this way, I know how it's all going to turn out for you. It's not that simple. Ecclesiastes 3:11, he has made everything beautiful in its time, and he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from beginning to end. God has purposefully done this for his reasons. But the express point of verse 10, this one fleeting and obscure life, is your one shot at serving God in this realm, in this period, this very brief time period of walking by faith. Letter B, great works can come from little men in little cities who die in obscurity. Better to continue as a wise man in quietness than to become a king who shouts foolishness and achieves fame. Let's read verses 13 through 18, and this narrative goes back and forth a few ways, but it's talking about the contrast of quiet wisdom that is despised in this world versus loud foolishness that is admired. Verse 13, I have also seen this example of wisdom under the sun, and it seemed great to me. There was a little city with few men in it, and a great king came against it and besieged it, building great siege works against it. Let's stop there and just appreciate what a siege is. A siege is when you cut a community off from food and water. And God predicted some sieges for Israel, which happened. And those are the situations in which people start drinking their own urine and eating their dead. Okay, so sieges are tough. They destroy cities slowly. They choke out life. And so anyway, this is what happened in this city. Verse 15. But there was found in it a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city. Yet no one remembered that poor man. But I say that wisdom is better than might. Even though in the previous verse this man was forgotten, wisdom is better than might. Though a poor man's wisdom is despised and his words are not heard, the words of the wise heard in quiet are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. Note the clear superiority of wisdom in this passage, but not for fame, not for recognition among this world of men. A wisdom might deliver you. It might even deliver your city, but it will not deliver you into fame and accolades. The wise man in verse 15 delivered a city and was forgotten. He reminds us of someone else in the Bible, a wise woman. A woman who delivered a city. And I want to ask you that woman's name after I read the narrative. 2 Samuel 20. There's a wicked man by the name of Sheba. It says, and Sheba passed through all the tribes of Israel to Abel of Beth-Ma'aka and came, and all the Bichrites assembled and followed him. And all the men who were with Joab, the other side of the equation, came and besieged him in Abel Beth-Ma'aka. They cast up a mound against the city, and it stood against the rampart. So what do we got going on here? Another siege. We're cutting off water. We're cutting off food. And they were battering the wall to throw it down. So the end is getting near. Then a wise woman called from the city. Listen, listen. Tell Joab, come here, that I may speak to you. And he came near to her. And the woman said, are you Joab? He answered, I am. Then she said to him, listen to the words of your servant. And he answered, I am listening. Then she said, they used to say in former times, let them but ask counsel in Abel. And so they settled a matter. What's she saying? She's saying, this is a city where people came to find reason and peace and good judgment. Okay, and so they settled a matter. I am one of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy a city that is a mother in Israel. Why will you swallow up the heritage of the Lord? Joab answered, far be it from me, far be it, that I should swallow up or destroy. That is not true, but a man of the hill country of Ephraim, called Sheba, the son of Bichri, has lifted up his hand against King David. Give up him alone, and I will withdraw from the city. And the woman said, now why is a woman doing this? Why didn't the men handle this right up front? Do you suppose that the men were like, wait a minute, you're attacking, what do you think you're doing here? You know, were the men putting up the resistance? And did it take this wise woman after the siege started to take its toll and people started to be more inclined to listen and to allow her to speak? Where were the men? We don't know, but this wise woman. And the woman said to Joab, behold, his head will be thrown to you over the wall. Then the woman went to all the people in her wisdom. And they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it out to Joab. So he blew the trumpet, and they dispersed from the city, every man to his home. And Joab returned to Jerusalem, the king. Would this woman's wisdom have been heard without a siege, without problems, without hardship, without toil? We don't know. But from what Solomon is telling us, it seems like she would not. It seems like men generally are not in a disposition to listen to quiet wisdom. What is the woman's name? We don't know. We don't know. So is her wisdom wasted? Was she wasting her life by living by wisdom? It didn't achieve her any fame. She didn't become a matriarch of Israel. Oh, but she saved her life and she saved the life of the city. I think she's to be an example of us to us in more than one way. She's wise, but she's also small. She's of no account. She's someone to be emulated. Solomon's society seems to have valued style over substance. I don't know if we can relate as Americans. Look at chapter 15 or verse 15. Okay, it says here, "But I say that wisdom is better than might, though the poor man's wisdom is despised." This is Solomon, and I take Koheleth to be Solomon, and this is Solomon saying that his society despises wisdom and doesn't hear wisdom. And then verse 16, "The words of the wise heard in quiet are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools." You would think that because this wise man had saved his city, he would now be the ruler. But that doesn't seem to be the case. It says he saved his city in verse 14. He delivered the city, yet no one remembered him. And the words of the wise heard in quiet would be better than the shouting of rulers among fools. But he says that the poor man's wisdom is despised. His words are not heard. Some of this seems like watching a modern political debate where one-liners and put-downs gain a politician more votes than substance on issues. One man makes a better president, but the other man will be the president if our society is like Solomon's, where wisdom is just simply not honored. Substance is not honored, but boy, look at that style. Verse 16 through 18 then is a generalization. "Though you are wise, you will not be heard until men are in a disposition to listen." In the story of verses 14 and 15, the oppression got the people's attention. The siege got their attention. They listened to the man, then they forgot about him. God may have to get America's attention before America will listen to the quiet wisdom of godly people. Is America listening to wisdom today? Does America value righteousness? No. Does that mean you should abandon it? No. We're not here to win accolades. We're not here to gain fame, popularity. We're not here to be remembered. It is not a popularity contest, wisdom. It is from God, and those with joy in God will live by wisdom in obedience to Him. So let's go to point two here. Carefully cultivate wisdom in your life, recognizing its desirability and the benefits it can bring to you. Solomon's already said it won't be listened to, it won't gain you fame, it won't gain you attention, but there are benefits to it, and he breaks it down into some categories here, I think, if I'm reading this correctly. In verses 1 through 4, I'm seeing a plea for complete wisdom in your life, to not give ground to foolishness. That giving ground to even a little foolishness, and let's face it, sometimes, you know, I've been just such a good boy that I think, I ought to be able to get away with. No. You invite that kind of foolishness, you undo a lot of good. So if we look at verse 18 of the previous chapter, "Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. Dead flies make the perfumer's ointment give off a stench. Even so, a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor." A wise man's heart inclines him to the right, but a fool's heart to the left. Even when the fool walks on the road, he lacks sense. And he says to everybody that he is a fool. "If the anger of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your place, for calmness will lay great offenses to rest." So I think that this is these verses 1 through 4 are a call to live by complete wisdom. Some see all of chapter 10, verses 1 through 20, as an illustration of how wisdom is better than folly. I tend to agree. And this first opening illustration is beautiful. Flies in a perfume give it a great stench. It's kind of like getting a hair in your food at the restaurant, okay? I mean, you know, at the molecular level, what's really gone wrong here? Probably not much. Probably that person washed his or her hair that morning. There's probably nothing going on that's wrong. But that one hair can destroy a very fine meal, can it not? or in the case of Dave Shaleen, a fellow pastor and former roommate of mine at Bible College, who was out with Heralds of Song, and they sat down to a meal at this nice farmhouse, and we're talking turkey and stuffing and mashed potatoes and gravy, and then at some point during the meal, a mouse, a live mouse, crawls out of the gravy dish, covered in gravy. Oh, man. The poor wife had just grabbed the gravy dish down. You know, who looks for a mouse? You know, I mean, typically, if you're me, I'm rinsing it out for dust, just saying. But, you know, not saying it couldn't happen to me, but that just, it's my way, you know. But, you know, she took it down, she dumped the gravy in, and this poor mouse is getting scalded. And it finally gets a foothold and gets out as everybody's eating. And that ended the meal. Okay, so this little mouse ruined a whole feast with, you know, with pounds and pounds of food. Well, even so, a little folly in your life can undo all of the good that you have had up to this point. And sometimes we reason that, oh, you know, I have the right, you know, give me this liberty. I mean, let's, you know, relax. It's me. Look at all that I've done. And here's the thing I see it in, and this is really odd. I see it with preachers who give cussing a go, and sometimes even in their sermon. I mean, sometimes you'll be out to lunch with a preacher, and they'll just fly off with a what the, you know, fill in the blank, and I'm like, where did that come from? And it's kind of like they're trying to be a little more sophisticated. I don't know, a little more cosmopolitan. Did you know that there was a study released a few weeks ago that people who swear have a larger vocabulary? I was like, yeah, if I have about 15 four-letter words at least, you know. I mean, that's kind of a tautology to say they've got a larger vocabulary. But it's just like, you know, but here's what it is. Swearing all of a sudden becomes attractive. You're a little more intellectual if you let loose with a colorful swear word, if you spice up your language a little bit. And what's interesting is preachers will try this as well, even from the pulpit. Oh, it gets people's attention, all right. But, you know, just a little bit of folly, a little bit of folly can pollute a great deal of righteousness in your life. The right hand versus left hand here, wisdom takes you to the right. Foolishness takes you to the left hand. There's always been this sense of the right hand, the hand of honor in the Middle East. In some cultures, the left hand is reserved for the nastier functions that you might have to do in life. So you would not regard the left hand. I don't know that that's in play here, but certainly the right being a place of honor. Wisdom will lead you to a place of honor. He's just said you won't get famous, so he's obviously not talking about this realm. Okay, he's talking about a place of honor with God. And with godly people, with wise people. Letter A, there are many absurd outcomes in many situations, and they sometimes originate with the king, and yet he's going to prescribe wisdom, and he's going to illustrate here how wisdom can still be beneficial. Look at verses 5 through 11. There's an evil that I have seen under the sun, as it were an error proceeding from the ruler. Now let's stop there. The ruler is in view here, and the ruler is going to be in view at the very end of the passage, end of the chapter. How much the ruler is infused in the background of what we're about to hear is a little hard to tease out, okay? But some of the follies that we deal with in life come from our own government, okay? This is Solomon's environment, not ours. But it says in verse 5, there's an evil I've seen done under the sun, as it were, an error proceeding from the ruler. Folly is set in many high places, and the rich, or the nobility, sit in a low place. I have seen slaves on horses and princes walking on the ground like slaves. And then he gives these common labor illustrations. He says, he who digs a pit will fall into it. You dig a pit to trap animals, for instance, and you get trapped. And a serpent will bite him who tears down a wall or breaks down a wall. Maybe you've got a wall and you're trying to put a gateway, and so you're taking rocks out, and there's a serpent, a snake hiding. That's happened to me. They didn't bite, but three times in one day. And I got a little skittish and a little wise by the end of that day. And he who splits logs is endangered by them. If the iron is blunt and one does not sharpen the edge, he must use more strength. But wisdom helps one to succeed. And I believe that statement covers everything that's been said heretofore through chapter 5, through verse 5. Verse 11, I don't know what to do with. I'll talk about it in a moment. If the serpent bites before it is charmed, there is no advantage to the charmer. Okay? So note that verse 5 draws attention to the king who allows some evil or some absurdities in his rule, or he fails to prevent some absurd things from happening under his rule. In verses 6 and 7. And then recall in chapter 8 that the blessings and the limits that we had with human government were mentioned as that God gives government to soften the evils of this life, but government has its limits. The king does not get a pass from war, for instance. There's always going to be wars in the world. And no matter how good your king is, there's going to be complications with war. As we look at the dangers of the activities in verses 8 and 9 here, you've got digging a pit to catch an animal and you fall into it. That can happen. You're dismantling a stone wall. Perhaps you're trying to do a breach. You're sieging a city and you're trying to tear apart a wall and all of a sudden there's a snake. Or maybe you're a farmer and you're tearing apart a fence and you're unstacking the stones that create the wall and there's a snake hiding and you get bit. The next guy is quarrying rocks, and that's pretty common in Israel when we go to the birthplace of Christ. I'm up here. It's not in my sermon notes. Where was he born? Bethlehem? There we go. That's how my mind doesn't think sometimes. But he's born in Bethlehem, and we look for this place where the manger might have been, where animals were stored. And we see these caves in these sandy rock hills. And what people would do is quarry their own rock and build caves for their animals at the same time. And so you're in there and you're quarrying this rock and you're building this cave and you're taking the rocks out to build your house outside. And all of a sudden, a big chunk falls on you and kills you or at least hurts you. That's the picture of what can happen here. We have finally the dangers inherent in splitting logs, which is easily enough recognizable. It's why when you go to the Boundary Waters, you don't swing an axe ever. Find other ways to get your firewood, because if you're up in the Boundary Waters, 2 days' journey from any health care, and you swing that axe and it slices open your leg when you miss, you're in pretty tough straits. So we understand these things. What I don't understand is after the statement about wisdom helps one to succeed. You can sharpen an edge and you'll have easier labor. You can be wise in how you dig a pit. You can be wise in how you take stones out of a wall. And you will learn that after you see a couple of snakes, I guarantee you. You can even be wise in interacting with a government ruler who has some obscure absurdities in the way he rules. How do we get to verse number 11? What's it saying? If the serpent bites before it's charmed, there is no advantage to the charmer. We may or may not be right to see a charmer of a snake as somebody with a little oboe that is playing and causing the snake to sway back and forth. The idea of charming a snake might be more like what we see in Africa in black magic, where people fear that the witch doctor is going to be hired by one of your neighbors to send a cobra into your shack to bite you. That is a snake that has been charmed, a snake that has been sent. And so you can then go spend money and pay the witch doctor to have charms of protection around your house. So this whole idea of charming snakes, it's a little hard to nail down. What are we talking about charming a snake here for? It could be an introduction into verse number 12 when it's talking about charming. The words of a wise man's mouth win him favor, but the lips of a fool consume him. So verse 11 could be there introducing the next section. I've put it with the previous section. And why do I do that? Because the snake could be the ruler that was mentioned in verse number 5. And here's the thing. If you're a courtier, if you're somebody in the court of the king, there's no such thing as just another day at the office. Every day is a day of risk because a king has power of life and death over you. And when things go wrong in the king's chambers, they go horribly wrong. And so all of this talk about wisdom could be a comparison here that, you know, you're doing your job, and just like the guy who tears down a wall or quarries rock, your work should yield provision for you and your family and satisfaction to your soul, but the royal snake can bite at any time. Wisdom can guide all men in their work, whether you're quarrying rock or whether you're in the presence of a king. So anyway, verse 11, a little bit of a challenge, but that's my best understanding of it. As we continue here, our last subpoint, wisdom can bring some stability to life while foolishness tends toward a life of chaos. In verses 12 through 20, it says in verse 12, the words of a wise man's mouth win him favor, but the lips of a fool consume him. So verse 12, words consume the fool in the end. Verse 13, initially the fool's words just comes off as foolishness, as folly, but it becomes wicked foolishness. It becomes a travesty at the end. Look at verse 13. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is evil madness. Foolish talk starts here, it ends somewhere vastly, horribly different. Verse 14, his usage of words is inversely proportional to his understanding of reality. Look at verse 14, a fool multiplies words, though no man knows what is to be, and who can tell him what will be after him. Now, verse 14, there's a little bit of a hint of God in there. Who can tell man what will be after him? God, okay. But what is the fool doing who has no affinity for God, no understanding of anything? He is multiplying words. His words and his understanding are inversely proportional. And in verse 15, we see that for all of the flapping about of his mouth, he really doesn't know his way. Verse 15, the toil of a fool wearies him, for he does not know the way to the city. Look back at verse 3. Even when the fool walks in the road, he lacks sense. The idea is, you're in one city, and this is the road called the Damascus Road, and it leads to Damascus, right? Okay, but the fool is out on the road, he does not know his way to the city. It's a road. You know, you follow the road. Okay, but he announces to everybody, I'm a fool, and he's sitting there standing around, turning in circles, not finding his way to the city. Utter foolishness. Proverbs 10, 19 and 20. Everything seems to be about the fool and his words in verses 12 through 15. So let me just quote Proverbs. It says, when words are many, transgression is not lacking. But whoever restrains his lips is prudent. The tongue of the righteous is choice silver. The heart of the wicked is little worth. Now, as we jump into verses 16, 17, and 20, we're going to be back into the king's presence. We're dealing with kingly issues once again. And Solomon paints a picture of an unwise king, and this picture is amazingly prophetic when you consider that his son is Rehoboam. Let me just read verses 16 through 20. It says, woe to you, O land! When your king is a child and your princes feast in the morning. Now, feasting in the morning does not mean we meet for a power breakfast at 4 a.m. to plan our day. Okay? Feasting in the morning means you never went to bed. It means you stayed up partying all night. Yes, they did this in antiquities as well as today. Verse 17, happy are you, O land, when your king is the son of the nobility and your princes feast at the proper time. What is the proper time? In the evening. And get this, for strength and not for drunkenness. See, there's a good feasting and there's an evil feasting here. Through sloth, the roof sinks in, and through indolence, which is idleness, the house leaks. This still applies to the king. This is talking about how nations are ruined. Through sloth and laziness. Bread is made for laughter, and wine gladdens life, and money answers everything, or money buys it all. Hey, let me ask you something. When the king parties, when the king feasts and gets drunk and spends all kinds of money, whose money is he spending? The people's. Thus it says, even in your thoughts, do not curse the king, nor in your bedroom curse the rich or the nobility. For a bird of the air will carry your voice, or some winged creature tell the matter. So this is Solomon giving wisdom, and there seems to be a lot of problems around kings and rulers and government in antiquities. And it's a very personal relationship if you're living in Jerusalem and there's a king in Jerusalem and you're bad-mouthing the king in his own city. This king, who's a young ruler, partying with his friends, eating, feasting in the wee hours of the early morning, reminds us of Rehoboam in 1 Kings 12. And they sent and called him, and Jeroboam and the assembly of Israel came and said to Rehoboam, your father made our yoke heavy. Now, therefore, lighten your hard services, the hard services of your father and his heavy yoke on us, and we will serve you. He said to them, go away 3 days and then come to me. So the people went away, and Rehoboam took counsel of the old men who stood before Solomon his father while he was yet alive, saying, how do you advise me to answer the people? And they said to him, if you will be a servant to this people today and serve them and speak good words to them, when you answer them, then they will be your servants forever. But he abandoned the counsel of the old men and gave him and took counsel with the young men who had grown up with him and who stood before him. Was Solomon writing about his own son? And he said to them, what do you advise that we answer this people who have said to me, lighten the yoke that your father has put on us? And the young men who had grown up with him said to him, thus you shall speak to the people who said to you, your father made our yokes heavy, but you lighten it for us. Thus you shall say to them, my finger is thicker than my father's thighs. And now, whereas my father laid on you a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. Verse 13, the king answered the people harshly, and forsaking the counsel that the old men had given him, he spoke to them according to the counsel of the young men. Verse 16, and when all Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, the people answered the king, what portion do we have in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. Look now to your own house, David. So Israel went to their tents. All of this, of course, was fulfilling God's purposes to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hands in chapter 11, verses 11 and 12 earlier. God has multiple purposes behind everything. But here we see the illustration of precisely what Solomon was warning about. That it is an unhappy land who has princes who party into the wee hours of the morning, who live for feasting on the dime of the people they are taxing. The admonition fits here because anyone with rulers like those described in these preceding verses would surely be tempted to gripe. And wisdom does not treat being on the wrong side of the law lightly. Do you see that in verse 20? Be careful not to say evil things against the king. It could get out. We can look to our politics for many applications of today's text that we've been reading. Politicians who multiply words in inverse proportion to their understanding of wisdom and the issues at hand. We could also apply this to our own lives. We live in an age where technology and science is bringing on more knowledge than we have the wisdom to handle. Somebody said by the time a newborn, one of these newborns here today, turns 50, 97% of the information in the world will have been new. What we know today is 3% of what they will know at that time. Does all of this information equate to wisdom? No. I heard this week that they have a model for a Death Star that can take out asteroids if the Earth is ever threatened. Wouldn't that be wise to have a Death Star floating around the Earth that somebody could have a trigger on? Maybe not. Drones that could not only monitor us, but be armed to take care of issues. I mean, that makes sense in certain limited situations where monitoring in the air would be helpful and having the ability to address the issue without risking a police officer's life would be helpful. But do we want to really live with drones floating around us 24 hours a day, watching us and ready to take us out if we do something wrong? Maybe wisdom would say not. Genetics, deep brain stimulation can create human minds that with mental capacities that are just bizarre. Should we create a new species or a new ability among man at that level? Information is fascinating, but will wisdom keep up? More to the point of this passage, will the wisdom of those in power keep up with information and technology? Some would say, well, that's why we have talk radio. That's why we got National Public Radio, to have these conversations and to create wisdom. Maybe, maybe not. But though the world forsake wisdom, Solomon is commending wisdom to you today. You're not going to be heard. You're not going to be famous in a wicked world that doesn't have your attention. But life will go better and judgment will go better. This is where Solomon's going in chapter 12. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God, keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. There is nobody who can tell you where this world is headed and where technology is leading us today. There's nobody who can tell you how much of the stuff we have today even ought to be used. As we search for wisdom on these matters, we are an inhibited race. But there is a God of the universe, and we fear him, and we keep his commandments. We will not be the loudest voice in the room. We will not be the flashiest. We will not become famous. And unless men are beaten into some circumstantial submission to wisdom, people aren't going to want to hear it. Think about Jesus as we go to communion here in just a moment. If you could have written the Jesus narrative, the Son of God coming to earth to visit mankind, to offer a kingdom to his people, if you could have written that narrative, I bet it would have been a fairy tale. I bet it would have been a delight at every turn. That's not the narrative God wrote. And yet God had multiple purposes in it. Likewise, though our lives are obscure, pursue wisdom and trust that God has multiple purposes in it.